Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, remembering Cardinal Francis Xavier Vantoin, a gentle hero who spent years in prison before rising to be a cardinal in the Vatican. And marching for peace from the slums of Nairobi to St. Francis's town of Assisi in Italy. And God in America. Are Americans more religious than people in other Western nations? Strong religious conviction appears to be important, even in the choices of U.S. voters. Benedict received members of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace on Monday, marking the fifth anniversary of the passing of the Council's former president, the Vietnamese Cardinal Francis Xavier Vantoin. Chris Altieri reports.
The president of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, Cardinal Renato Raffaele Martino, remembered Cardinal Vantoin as a person who lived an heroic life of Christian witness.
Che nella memoria e nella preghiera.
Cardinal Martino said his predecessor was an indomitable servant of the Church and the gospel of justice and peace. Pope Benedict remembered Cardinal Vantoin's many accomplishments, which included opening the work that became the compendium to the social doctrine of the Catholic Church.
Come dimenticare gli spiccati tratti.
The Holy Father especially recalled the Cardinal's simple and immediate cordiality, as well as his ability to speak and be neighborly with anyone and everyone. After a lengthy and painful battle with cancer, Cardinal Vantoin died on September 16, 2001. His cause for beatification is underway. I'm Chris Altieri.
Well, Charles Collins now takes a look at this man who many call a gentle hero of the Church.
I was in prison in Center, Vietnam. I was liberated after 13 years, 4 months, and 27 days.
That's the voice of Cardinal Francois Xavier Nguyen Van Thanh, the president of the Vatican's Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace. His story of imprisonment by the communist government in Vietnam inspired millions. In 1994, he spoke to Vatican Radio about his 13 years in a concentration camp.
When the communists came, I was arrested because the appointment of a new bishop 7 days before their arriving was considered as a conspiracy between the Vatican and the imperialism to strengthen the anti-communist struggle.
7 days before Saigon collapsed in 1976, then Archbishop Tuan had just been transferred to the city's archdiocese. When the communists took the city, he was thrown into prison. He spent the following years in different prison camps, 9 years of which were in solitary confinement, until his release in 1988. Archbishop Tuan said physical and spiritual exercises kept him going. Just walking in his prison cell, praying and writing helped him avoid being overcome with anguish and got him through his many bouts with malnutrition and disease.
I consider everything as the mysterious way of God for the salvation and for the sanctification. And it is very hard also, and sometimes I was sick. Sometimes I can pray. But I think I must change the weakness into strength. I remember somebody said, for the pessimist, every opportunity is a calamity. But for the optimist, every calamity is an opportunity. And as a Christian, a priest, I can be optimist because there is God with me. I am not alone, and I am optimist.
His optimism sustained him, as did his knowledge of the church in his homeland. With the improved political and social climate in Vietnam, there is an increased interest in the religion for which the cardinal suffered so much. The fruits of his sufferings, and the sufferings of so many others in the Vietnamese church, is that over 3,000 baptisms now take place every year. The cardinal always kept track of the situation of the church in Vietnam, and in this case, he recounted the story of a group of people who made a 6-day journey just to be baptized.
In the north, there is a tribe close to the border with Laos and China, and they are far away from the first priest, about 6 days walking in the mountains, and they came. 6 days coming, staying 2 days, and going back 6 days, 14 days, and bringing rice with them to eat. And they came to ask for conversion.
Cardinal Tuan said the witness of church leaders and members during Vietnam's toughest times are the seed which has sparked the recent growth in Christianity.
During the trials, tribulations, they see that the church is always truthful for them. We are faithful to the gospel, and we remain during the trials.
The example of Cardinal Tuan is an inspiration to all. While in prison, he fashioned a Bible out of scraps of paper. He fashioned a crucifix out of some wood and the barbed wire which confined him. He was released from prison in 1988 and came to Rome, in exile from his homeland. Pope John Paul II made him a cardinal on February 21, 2001. The church's new cardinal never forgot where he came from. Instead of the usual pectoral cross of silver or gold, Cardinal Francis Xavier Nguyen Van Thon still wore the cross he fashioned from barbed wire and a fence post, a sign of solidarity with the suffering church in Vietnam and throughout the world.
From the slums of Nairobi to the pristine cobblestone streets of the Italian hill town of Assisi, for nearly a decade, Father Renato Cizzito has been organizing a peace march each year ahead of the annual Prayers for Peace celebrations in the Umbrian town of St. Francis. Father Cizzito, an Italian Comboni missionary who formed the Koinonia community in Kenya for abandoned and orphaned children, got his 200 or so kids together for the first peace march out of Nairobi's slums. Well, today they are joined by thousands of people, young and old, who want to draw attention to the desperate needs of Africa's poor. They're crying out for justice, says Father Cizzito. And without justice, there can be no peace in this world. Each fall, Father Cizzito joins other leaders of human rights and peace organizations in their march from one of Kenya's most violent slums, Kibera, down to Uhuru Park in downtown Nairobi. It's a symbol of how the desire for peace, Father Cizzito told me, can overcome even the fiercest of hearts.
We wanted to have a demonstration saying that we wanted peace. Many of the people who took part in the march were from Rwanda, Burundi, from Sudan, from Somalia, from all countries around Kenya where there is no peace. Or there was no peace, or where peace is still very fragile. Kenya itself is a country where there is a lot of hidden institutional violence where the powerful are clamping down on the powerless and the rich on the poor. And the physical violence that erupts from time to time in the slums is only an eruption, is only the visible part of this violence. So we think we need peace in Africa. We need peace, and we need the church to be more involved in preparing, in educating people for peace. My personal experience is I came to Africa almost exactly 30 years ago. I was absolutely not prepared to face the violence, the wars, the division, the hatred I found myself facing throughout these years. And I think that it is a very important ministry we have to develop, we have to understand better, we have to promote. So the mass wants to be a sign of the involvement of the church in this activity, though most of the people taking part will not take part in the name of the church as such, but is a manifestation organized by lay people.
Father, you're linking this this peace march in some way, I understand, to the Pope's message of peace in Assisi, Italy. How so?
Actually, we started the first peace march we held. It was the 1st of January 2001, the World Day of Peace according to the Catholic Church. So we started, all the organizers of the march are really people committed to Christianity, people that believe in the message of the Church and believe in the fact that the recent popes have been some of the best defender of peace in our present time. But then we thought that would limit too much our message. And so we chose to have the peace march in coincidence with the peace day proclaimed by the United Nations, so as to try to involve as many people as possible. Last year, we had Muslim friends taking part in it. We had people from every walk of life in Nairobi. We cannot say that it is still, or it is yet, a great manifestation. Maybe we have 4,000, 5,000 people taking part in it. But for us, it is a great success since we started a few years ago. Only with 203 children doing the peace march. And for us, it is a sign that really we are answering a need. We are answering a cry from the African poor. They want peace. They want justice. Peace is inevitably linked with justice. We try to do is to promote participation, is to promote awareness, to make sure that the poor understand that they can do something. When we did the last peace march on the occasion of the World Social Forum here in Nairobi in January, we did the peace march from Kibera, that is the greatest slum in Nairobi, to the center of town. We were afraid ourselves because it was the first time we try to do something like that. And Kibera is notorious for violence. To say Kibera and to say violence in Kenya, it is the same. Every manifestation, every public initiative held in Kibera used to finish with violence, with confrontation between different parties. Often it is politically motivated, by people who are using the poor, or anyhow we ended up in chaos because for the poor the temptation to end up looting and taking things that they saw around them was too much. They could not resist. Now, in January, the peace march from Kibera to the center of town was a march full of joy, of happiness. a message extremely positive. That was for us an enormous success. People start linking Kibera not with violence, but linking Kibera with young people, because the participants are mainly young people who want peace and are clamoring for peace, singing songs, dancing, showing their determination to do something good, something positive for their country. This awareness is what we try to promote.
Father Renato Kitsito is founder of Koinonia and Africa Peace Point, two Kenyan NGOs working to promote human rights and peace education across Africa. Can believing in God make you happy? How important is religion in your life? And would you be more likely to vote for a political leader who shares your own religious fervor or belief? Well, these were just some of the sort of questions asked Americans in a set of recent surveys. If you're American, you probably won't be surprised by the results. If you're not, you might be amazed. A whopping 70% of Americans feel it's important for their president to have strong religious beliefs. And almost half of young Americans surveyed say religion and spirituality are a very important part of their lives. And that's one reason they say they're as happy as they are. Well, I wonder how many young people in Europe would say the same. In fact, these polls seem to suggest the U.S. is in some way resisting the relentless slide into secularization that Pope Benedict and Pope John Paul before him have been so concerned about in Europe. The findings of these two surveys confirm what many Americans have known for a long time, that theirs is a nation where strong religious conviction is much more common than elsewhere in the developed world. But why the difference between the U.S. and other Western nations when it comes to the question of religion? And what impact does religion have on American politics and on society as a whole? Well, to find out more, Susie Hodges spoke to Father Jim Martin, associate editor at America Magazine, a leading U.S. Catholic weekly.
America is supposed to be the most religious, one of the most religious countries in the West, and I think they are, you know, in a sense, projecting onto the president onto that office what they themselves find important in their own lives.
At the same time, this survey shows that the Democratic and Republic frontrunners for the 2008 race for the White House, that's Hillary Clinton and Rudy Giuliani, are viewed as the least religious among the top contenders. Isn't there somehow here an inconsistency?
Well, I think it all needs to be seen in terms of sort of relative religiosity. Hillary Clinton is still a very religious person and speaks frequently about her Methodist upbringing. And Rudy Giuliani often makes a point of touting his own Catholicism. So while they are the least religious, perhaps, of the major candidates, they are still, overtly religious when they are campaigning.
And when it comes to the American public, among what social or ethnic groups is religion seen as the most important factor here?
Well, I think that that sort of ranges. There are many sort of traditionally religious ethnic groups, say, for example, Italian-Americans and Irish-Americans, who are predominantly Catholic, you know, for whom religion is still important. However, these days, I think Americans vote more with their wallets and their pocketbooks, as we say, than they do according to religious denominations or across church lines. So I think things like the economy and certainly, for example, the war in Iraq are going to be more important than any sort of religious consideration.
In fact, it's interesting that apparently the so-called hot-button social and ethical issues like abortion and gay marriage are way down the list of voter priorities, according to this survey. Why is that? And does that surprise you?
Well, I think the reason why, I think, is because Iraq is such a dominant political issue right now, and that most people really do understand that in terms of, you know, the situation in Iraq, and also just bluntly how much it's costing the United States in terms of lives and money. I saw an estimate that said we would we would be in the order of $1.2 trillion in debt for the Iraq War. So I think people understand that as a very critical problem. And then second of all, I think that, you know, abortion and gay marriage, in a sense, don't seem to be as kind of critical issues. They might be, you know, the sort of social issues that people like to think are important. But when it comes down to saying, you know, what's the most important thing in my life, I abortion and gay marriage simply aren't up there.
A separate survey found that nearly half of all young Americans say religion or spirituality is very important to them. Here again, this survey shows that the rates of strong religious conviction are far higher in the US than elsewhere in the developed world. Why is it that the US appears to buck the trend towards growing secularization in the West? Why does it stand out on its own in this field?
Well, that's a difficult question. I would say one thing is that we have never had the experience of having a state religion. You know, we are a relatively young country compared to other Western nations who had to struggle to disentangle themselves from state religions. And we have a long history of religious tolerance and religious freedom. And so I think people feel more comfortable expressing religiosity. That's the first thing. But at the same time, it's very interesting. America was founded by people who themselves, you know, the Pilgrims and the Puritans, who were very religious. So there is always a religious underpinning in American history. So you have this very interesting kind of double-edged sword whereby there was no state religion, but by the same token, religion has always been very important. So people feel free to be religious and also look at that as part of the national heritage.
Do you, in fact, think that this divergence between the U.S. and other developed nations when it comes to the importance of religion could widen further?
It seems to me that Western Europe in particular, I mean, this is one of Pope Benedict's biggest challenges. Western Europe is becoming more and more secular as the United States becomes more and more religious. The only thing that I think that mitigates that is that more people in the United States speak about themselves as spiritual but not religious, to use the phrase that's being used these days. So, you know, I think it depends what you mean by religious. You know, I think church going is going down, but people's idea of spirituality is on the rise. So it's very difficult to see where it's going, but one of the trends, I think, is for people to disassociate themselves with organized churches.
This survey also found that young people who describe themselves as very religious tend to be happier than those who don't. This was, in fact, one of the main points of the survey. Do you think this is a finding that can be applied to all age groups of religious believers in the U.S.?
Well, I do. I think that certainly religion gives, at the most basic level, gives your life meaning. And second of all, on a sort of practical level, you could say that religious communities give you a sense of belonging to something wider than yourself. I think one of the dangers I always tell people of being spiritual but not religious is that you are untethered to any sort of religious community. That can give you a sense of belonging. It can also moderate, you know, what might be selfish desires, for example. So I do think, I'm not surprised that people who belong to religious organizations are happier. That makes total sense to me. And I think on a theological level, they're able to find God in the community, and through that are able to, you know, find more joy in their lives.
Another interesting aspect of this survey, though, was that although many young people in the U.S. have these strong religious convictions, at the same time, two-thirds of them would appear to be remarkably tolerant about other religions. They say that while they follow their own religious beliefs, they say that others could be true as well. That's quite a high finding, isn't it?
It is, but it's not surprising at all. I mean, the United States is a very diverse country when it comes to religion. From the beginning on the East Coast, while the original settlers were Protestants, you quickly had Catholics and Quakers and Jews and all sorts of, especially Christian denominations, entering into the picture very quickly. So, you know, in a place like New York City where I live, you have, literally every world religion represented in the city. And so when people are forced to live together, I think they grow in tolerance. Now, that changes from state to state. Some states are very heavily Christian. Some states are more mixed. But in general, Americans have had to learn to live with one another and live with other religions. And so this tolerance, I think, is almost a byproduct of kind of proximity that we have grown up with. So that figure doesn't surprise me at all. And it's actually, I think, one of the best parts of our country.
And you think that this trait of being tolerant and open and accepting other people's religious beliefs is not just confined then to the younger generation?
I actually think it's not confined to just the younger generation, but I think it's more prevalent in the younger generation because they are much more likely to mix with people that are different from themselves. There's more mobility that goes, you know, along with being younger these days in the United States, you know, whereas before a person might have been born, grown up, and died in the same town. That's very unusual these days. People travel all over the country to different colleges. They travel all over the country for their jobs and their businesses. So this kind of mobility, I think, increases the interaction you have with people from different religious faiths. So I think that tolerance will only grow, which I think ultimately is a good thing. It's also a challenge for the church, too, for the Catholic Church, in terms of not only attracting people, but making its message known without feeling that it's shutting out other people, for example, from salvation. But, you know, all these things that the Catholic Church in the United States has been dealing with for centuries.
Father Jim Martin is associate editor at America Magazine, a leading U.S. Catholic weekly. He was talking there to my colleague Susie Hodges. How can we put our faith into practice in our everyday lives, especially at a time when many see religion as a cause of conflict rather than a cause for peace? Father Tom Williams, Rector of Theology at the Pontifical Athenaeum Regina Apostolorum, sat down with me for some insight on interfaith dialogue, not between religious leaders, but beginning with the common Christian.
I think that this is ever more important. We live in such a pluralistic world, a pluralistic society now, that we are continually coming in contact with people of other faiths. And we have two options. We can either close ourselves into a sort of ghetto, a self-imposed ghetto, or we can open ourselves up to learn from them, to share with them our own faith, and to really make that coming into contact something fruitful for both of us.
Okay, but how do I do that? I'm Sue Smith, and I'm living in Oklahoma City, and I've got, you know, my own problems, my own issues every day. Why should it be important to me?
Well, because, Sue Smith, you probably have friends who are of different faiths. You run into people all the time. It's important in the first place for you to know about them, what they believe, why they believe what they believe. It helps even your friendships grow. It helps your understanding of them grow. And also, you're called as a Christian to witness to your own faith. And part of being in society is going beyond your own problems, which are very real, to also share your faith with other people. To know it in the first place and be willing to express it and talk about it with other people as well. There's a popular misunderstanding with regard to interfaith dialogue, which is that means checking your own faith at the door, at the coat check, and then walking in as if you didn't believe anything, just to listen afresh to someone talking about his or her faith. And that's false. Pope Benedict, on a number of occasions, also before he was Pope, spoke about the need for a strong personal identity to enter into dialogue. For there to be a fruitful dialogue, you have to know who you are and what you believe. That's what you bring to the table. You don't leave that at the door. So when you go in and speak with someone from a different faith, you are joyfully and with great conviction speaking about your own faith. Also, you know, this isn't separated from evangelization. You also would like that person to embrace Jesus Christ. This is part of what we believe. We're a missionary church, and we believe that when we announce the good news of the gospel, that that seed will fall, sometimes on good soil. There will be those who want to embrace it, and we're also called to be missionaries through this dialogue.
And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.